AM, the evening news program that many of you have come to know and trust. Welcome again to those listeners who've been listening for over a decade to Lou and me. This is Elizabeth Cuppet Caverly.
And Lou Caverly.
And tonight we're going to be bringing you a lot of important news. It seems as though the motif is life versus death. And there are two kinds of death. There is physical death, but there is also moral or spiritual death. And we can look at America right now, and we can be comforted, Lou. America has not changed. America is the America you and I have always loved, because Twinkies are back on the shelves July 15th.
That's a relief.
You're so relieved, aren't you? Hostess is betting on a sweet comeback for Twinkies when they return to shelves next month. Based on the outpouring of nostalgia sparked by its demise, Hostess is expecting a blockbuster return next month for Twinkies and other sugary treats such as cupcakes and donuts. The company said the cakes will taste the same, but the boxes will now bear the tagline, "The sweetest comeback in the history of ever." Would it be that America could have such a comeback of repentance and acknowledgement of God's laws in our midst? But we see this motif of life and death, and when we think about July the 4th, or if we think about Memorial Day, we think about our veterans, and again, we see that we may be heading into another big war. Perhaps this is the granddaddy of them all. Perhaps it will be World War III. Washington Post, Friday, June 14th, had the headline, U.S. to scale up military support for Syrian rebels. Karen DeYoung and Ann Guerin were reporting, the United States has concluded that the Syrian government used chemical weapons in its fight against opposition forces, and President Obama has authorized direct U.S. military support to the rebels, the White House said Thursday. So they say, again, that we had, quote, high certainty that Syrian government forces used chemical weapons. Where have we heard that before?
Oh, seems to me we heard it about a decade ago.
Yes, we did, with Iraq and all of that scandal that came out, and Valerie Plame lost her CIA cover because her husband told the truth about it. Well, this article says Obama has, quote, not made any decision to pursue a military option such as a no-fly zone and has ruled out the deployment of U.S. ground troops. We heard that before, too, didn't we? When the erosion begins of our liberty to involve us in these illegal wars, all these foreign entanglements that our early forefathers who founded this country as a constitutional republic decried, anything can happen. The shipments to begin in a matter of weeks are likely to be undertaken by the CIA. So, okay, we'll see what happens with that. Then we know that our veterans are harmed from the other wars, the long, interminable war of Afghanistan. And in our neighborhood here in Eastern Maryland, the Eastern Shore of Maryland, that picturesque place that everybody likes to come as tourists to try the crab cakes. Well, June 17th in the local paper, we had a story of Easton welcoming the Marines. Marine Lance Corporal Jonathan Carnes had lost a leg, and Marine Lance Corporal Christian Brown had lost both of his legs in combat duty. Both Marines were wounded after stepping on explosive devices in Afghanistan. They were joined by their buddy, former active duty Marine Michael Maruza from Northern California. The outing was arranged by Operation Open Arms, a registered 501c3 public charity that was the brainchild of Captain John Giddyup Bunch of Oxford. Bunch began going to local businesses asking for free services for soldiers 8 years ago, arranging vacations, fishing trips, dental work, hotels, post-traumatic stress disorder care, and other services. Well, we would really applaud the Americans who are doing things like this. But on a national level, we had an editorial viewpoint out of the Jacksonville Daily News, and this appeared in another paper on June 11th, Nation must do better by our veterans. We speak of the backlog of Veterans Administration disability claims that has become a crisis and a national outrage. While the VA and its leadership, the latest being Secretary Eric Shinseki, have repeatedly pledged to speed up the process and remove the backlog, the reality is the average wait for first-time disability to be processed is now more than 300 days, and according to a letter recently sent to President Barack Obama by 67 U.S. senators, some veterans, quote, continue to wait 800 days, 900 days, and even more than 1,000 days for a disability claims decision from the VA. With an estimated 875,000 veterans on waiting lists for disability claims, it is a monumental challenge, yet a challenge that must be conquered. A Harvard University report indicates that one of every two veterans from Afghanistan or Iraq has applied for permanent disability benefits, undoubtedly higher than any previous wars our nation has fought. The VA must do better. When we think of our military services, we think of certain ideals: teamwork, discipline, sacrifice, putting nation before self. These ideals need to be applied by the VA administration in resolving the horrendous backlog in disability claims, because failure to do so not only is a disservice to our returning veterans, but is blatant disrespect for those who defend us, and that is intolerable. If we only had Art Bernclough still on earth, fighting with the veterans for constitutional law, but no, we believe very strongly he is in heaven with our Lord Jesus Christ, departing this earth, March of 2012, Art would be raising a hue and cry about all of this. Lou, when you think about this, 1,000 days, how many years is that approximately?
Very nearly 3 years.
Now imagine this. How do their families survive? It is truly disgusting. So the death goes on, and if you let your sons and daughters and granddaughters and grandsons go to the next war in Syria, there's something wrong with you as a Christian parent or grandparent. That's what I think, and you must pray that God will intervene, that we stay out of these wars. But we have the dark side always emerging. The death, the strange death of Michael Hastings, said to be working on his biggest story yet about the CIA. Paul Joseph Watson weighed in at Infowars.com June 25th, and he said his friend, he was Sergeant Joe Biggs, told Fox News' Megyn Kelly that his friends and everybody who knew him said he drove like a grandma. There was no way he would be driving out of control. And Biggs said he had contacted Mercedes to ask them if it was normal for their cars to blow up to that extent and for the engine to fly out 100 feet from the site of the crash. Well, it sounds pretty strange. And Aaron Schwartz, the person who supposedly hanged himself when he was going to be brought up on charges of hacking and so forth and so on, that too looks like it was not a suicide. But, you know, we don't want to know too much. If we knew too much, Lou, then we'd have to choose between life and death. And Congress, according to Infowars.com, June 25th, Congress insisted they be kept in the dark on NSA spying. Let's find out a little bit more about that.
Congress insisted to be kept in the dark on the NSA surveillance programs recently revealed by Edward Snowden, according to Dick Cheney, who approached the lawmakers with an invitation for them to provide more oversight back in 2004, but was told, quote, absolutely not, unquote. Speaking at a Washington think tank on U.S.-Korean affairs, the former vice president bragged about his involvement in setting up NSA programs shortly after 9/11 that snooped on email and phone records. Cheney also revealed that when he approached congressional leaders about whether they wished to provide oversight for the program 3 years after it began, they were, quote-unquote, unanimous that it should continue. Said Cheney, quote, I said, do you think we ought to come back to the Congress in order to get more formal authorization? And they said, absolutely not. Everybody, Republican and Democrat, said, don't come back up here. It will leak. Unquote. Cheney's claim that Snowden's revelations have caused significant damage to U.S. national security has been rejected by other top security experts, who assert that terrorists already assume that communications are under surveillance and are therefore unaffected by the information released by the whistleblower. Quote, the arguments that this sweeping search must be kept secret from the terrorists is laughable. Terrorists already assume this sort of thing is being done. Only law-abiding American citizens were blissfully ignorant of what their government was doing, said top counterterrorism czar under Presidents Clinton and Bush, Richard Clark. The former head of the NSA's Global Digital Data Gathering Program, William Binney, also highlighted how mass NSA surveillance did nothing to prevent terrorism. In addition, the claim that the program prevented terror attacks on targets such as Wall Street and the New York subway has also been debunked. Cheney's revelation that Congress was completely uninterested in learning about the PRISM program and other NSA snooping initiatives 9 years before they caused a global scandal underscores how lawmakers are continually willing to give the federal government a blank check to abuse constitutional rights. Given the fact that Congress is not only failing to perform its duty of acting as a check and balance in providing oversight of government, federal government activity, but actually demanding its role be the opposite, a green light for unrestrained spying, is it any wonder that the congressional job approval has been on a continual slide since 9/11? A recent Rasmussen report survey found that just 1% of Americans think Congress is doing an excellent job, and 5% think it's doing a good job. Figures that are well-deserved, given that lawmakers, besides a notable few, have completely abrogated their responsibility to keep the executive branch under scrutiny.
And many of the mainstream media yes-men like Gene Lyons, Charles Krauthammer, others in the Washington Post are really painting this picture of Snowden as a complete terrorist, not as a heroic figure like we heard Ron Paul discuss. And we have read that Daniel Ellsberg with the Pentagon Papers feels that he is more of a patriot than Ellsberg was himself. And I read one person who was saying it was fine for Ellsberg, I believe this was Susan Estrich, in sort of a weak-minded, illogical speech to convince that, in other words, it was okay for Ellsberg to leak all of this because it made a difference in the lives. It saved lives because it told that our country was not telling the truth about the Vietnam War. But this is now different with Snowden. And I think it's more horrifying than poor Susan Estrich can realize, because you and I have known for almost a decade that our phone was always tapped. Things happened. I mean, this was just one example of the phone listening. We told a friend at Salisbury, Maryland, that we would send her a copy of a video that we got probably from Alex Jones, and I told her this on the telephone. So Lou then went to the Easton, Maryland post office right at closing time. He mailed the package to her, and when she got it, it was all broken to bits. Maybe you'll say that was just a coincidence. There are many other examples we could give. When we got the book Living in Sodom from the Southwest Radio Church Ministry, oops, so sorry, the package was completely damaged. So many things have happened. It's just, you're a math teacher. There were too many to be just coincidental, weren't there?
Oh, yes, way too many. Yeah.
Way, 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 way too many. But you see, thing is, Susan Estrich is a liberal. She likes the Clintons. She likes all of this. But I think she has a good heart. I've seen her write about her family and other things. But you see, she's a liberal who hasn't fully realized the true danger in this kind of a Stasi mass spy network on every American. And you can't tell me that they're telling the truth, Lou, when they say they don't take any of the content of the calls. They merely check out who's calling whom and the date and so forth. No, Our own experience has shown us this. They're listening. They use echelon. They use keywords. We don't know what all advances they have by this point. But what is that new data center that you said looked like Area 51? It's vast. What's it going to hold if it doesn't have some ways to figure out the content? Because they must know the plans of the Tea Party members. If there are any militias that form when things get worse, they're going to have every bit of an email, the content, every bit of the content from the landline, from the cell phone. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes. And the most frightening thing of all is that, is it going to get to the point where if you say, I don't like Obama, or I don't like Clinton.
Phew, here comes the drone.
Oh, I don't.
Whoop, you're gone.
Right. Or I don't like George W. Bush. It doesn't matter what the party is. It's who's in power at the time. And it may get to the point where, as it was in Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia, you don't dare say anything unless you walk out in the woods, and can, or better still, out in the field where you can see maybe 1,000 yards in every direction and whisper in the other person's ear.
That's true. And you know, you and I have been under those constraints for about a decade now. We tried to get an old car because I said, let's get one that doesn't have the black box as described by Alex Jones. So we had this old, old, old car, and it gave us so much trouble. This might be also a lesson, too. Too many of our listeners, we fear, are living in the fear of the martial law, and what can I do to survive? I don't think God wants this kind of attitude. I think He wants you to stand up, stand right where you are now, and stand for the good, because the war is not completely over yet between this life and death. Now, Eli Lake at the Daily Beast had the headline, Greenwald, Snowden's files are out there if anything happens to him. This was June 26th. As the U.S. government presses Moscow to extradite former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden, America's most wanted leaker has a plan B. The former NSA systems administrator has already given encoded files containing an archive of the secrets he lifted from his old employer to several people. If anything happens to Snowden, the files will be unlocked. So they go on and they get into some depth about this, that the people in possession of these files, quote, cannot access them yet because they are highly encrypted and they do not have the passwords. But Greenwald said, quote, if anything happens at all to Edward Snowden, he told me he has arranged for them to get access to the full archives. The fact that Snowden has made digital copies of the documents he accessed while working at the NSA poses a new challenge to the U.S. intelligence community that has scrambled in recent days to recover them and assess the full damage of the breach. Even if U.S. authorities catch up with Snowden and the 4 classified laptops the Guardian reported he brought with him to Hong Kong, the secrets Snowden hopes to expose will still likely be published. When we think about this war that's going on here in America, our old beloved America, we look in the Bible at Mark 4, and we would begin reading there, verse 24. And if a kingdom be divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. And if Satan rise up against himself and be divided, he cannot stand, but hath an end. No man can enter into a strong man's house and spoil his goods, except he will first bind the strong man, and then he will spoil his house. Now, that particular verse that I concluded with is very important. You see, America was a strong man's house, and the goods could not be spoiled till Satan bound the strong man, when abortion became legalized with Roe versus Wade, and the mass slaughter of the unborn began. That was one of the things. When the same-sex marriage began to increase its dominion, again, we see another binding. Now, we don't know how long it's going to take till the cup of abomination is filled when God brings the full judgment, but we do believe that books like The Harbinger and books like Brie Keaton's America Repent, little book that she wrote, are seeing that God is giving at least the judgment warnings. He's beginning to withdraw His hand of protection from America. And when we think about this life and death Ashley, we think now literally of the deaths of these small babies not born. And first we see in Maryland, and it was a tiny article, not on the front page where it should have been. This is another Kermit Gosnell situation. No, it was hidden in the Eastern Shore newspaper, just a tiny little article. Board restores license of abortion clinic doctor. This was Sunday, June 16, 2013. Baltimore, AP. A Maryland state board has restored the license of a doctor who is the medical director for a group of Maryland abortion clinics. The clinics were shut down after a patient died at one clinic, and regulators found lax procedures at all four. Don't we wonder what lax procedures mean? It means, is
That's
it like
big.
At Gosnell's where they found these hideous things?
Yeah.
We don't know. The Maryland Board of Physicians online records show that Dr. Mansoor Panna's license was restored this week after the board determined that no, quote, substantial likelihood of a risk of serious harm to the public health, safety, and welfare, end of quote, existed. Panna was one of three doctors working for Associates in OBGYN Care. That's the name of the firm, if we call it a firm. Note that term, firm. Well, you know what that's connected with usually, John Grisham's book. It's that, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a very murderous mafia here. It's far worse than the real mafia. Absolutely. Panna was one of three doctors working for Associates in OBGYN Care whose licenses were suspended. The board also this week upheld the license suspension of Dr. Michael Basco. The third physician, Dr. Iris Dominey, still has a summary suspension on her license, according to online records. And I had to wonder, an old friend of mine, several decades ago, went to a doctor named Panna, P-A-N-A-H. Now, this name would not be too common because it is an Indian name. And this person told me that she actually considered bringing a legal case against this man because of sexual harassment. And when she didn't do what he wanted her to do, he hurt her during an examination. Now, if this is the same man or maybe the father of this Dr. Mansoor Panna, we don't know. But we do know that something more should have been done than this after that patient died. And now, when we talk about this war between life and death, it's not over yet in this country. And I think it is a demonic influence that is at work on some of the patriot broadcasters when they say America is done, it's all over, because Jesus did not tell us to give up and sit and wait for martial law, did he, Lou?
No, he did not.
What are we commanded to do?
Keep working. Work while you still have the light.
Yes, and now we have a lot of problems with Governor Rick Perry. He went to the Bilderberg meetings, a lot of other things, but we'd have to say this looks good. And give us this latest information on what's going on in Texas concerning abortion.
Okay, this is Dateline Austin, Texas, and the date was June 27, 2013. Governor Rick Perry on Wednesday called a second special session of the Texas legislature to pass widespread abortion restrictions across the nation's second largest state after the first attempt by Republicans died overnight following a marathon one-woman filibuster. Perry ordered lawmakers to meet again on July 1st to act on the abortion proposals, as well as separate bills that would boost highway funding and deal with the juvenile justice issue. The sweeping abortion rules would close nearly all the state's abortion clinics and impose other widespread restrictions. Perry can call as many 30-day extra sessions as he likes, but lawmakers can only take up those issues he assigns. The debate over abortion restrictions led to the most chaotic day in the Texas legislature in modern history, starting with a marathon filibuster and ending with a down-to-the-wire frenetic vote marked by questions about whether Republicans tried to break chamber rules and jam the measure through. Democrats put their hopes on thwarting the bill in the hands of Wendy Davis, a state senator clad in pink running shoes, for a day-long attempt to talk the bill to death. Over the duration of the speech, Davis became a social media star, even becoming the subject of a tweet from President Obama for her efforts. But just before midnight, Republicans claimed she strayed off topic and got help with the back brace, two things that are against filibuster rules, and cut her off. That cleared the way for a vote. But when Republican Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst shouted into the microphone trying to call the final votes, nobody seemed to hear him. Some 400 supporters jammed into the gallery, had taken their feet with a deafening roar, drowning out his voice. It was, as some say, a quote-unquote people's filibuster, an attempt to by protesters to finish what Davis had started more than 11 hours earlier.
So that situation is not over yet, is it?
No, that's right.
So we need to have quite a bit of prayer there, because there may be an act two to this. We do hope so. Someone who has always stood against the horrors of abortion is Dr. Carl Sanders, our co-host on this program, The Divided Kingdom. And we do ask every person listening tonight to put him in your deepest prayers. We did not know, we talked with him today, we did not know that he had had a serious heart attack and that his one remaining kidney has failed completely and he is on dialysis. So we ask you to pray from the depths of your heart that if God has more work for him to do here in this pivotal time in which we find out whether the American Christian community is going to stand to protect the strong man from being bound up. We need voices like Dr. Carl Sanders. So we do ask you out there to pray for him, that if God's purpose includes him continuing to work for all of us here, he will heal him. He will give Carl the kind of miracle he had once before in about 1990 when he was dying of colon cancer and he gave his life to the Lord. But we know that God's plan for us, each of us, has a certain time that we live and a certain time that we die. And sometimes with this death-life issue that we're talking about, the time is cut off by Satan's terrible, terrible temptations. And we're thinking of a young man's body that was found here on the eastern shore of Maryland maybe about a week ago, and he was lying by his car, and he had been a graduate of a small Christian school at which Lou and I used to teach, and there he was. So it seemed as though something was being covered up. Nothing would get reported on, but they were waiting till they had the evidence. And sadly now they are charging a 17-year-old with strangling him. And it sounds as though there was a party of them using LSD. This is just so sad. Two young lives. One was snuffed out physically. The other one is snuffed out at this time spiritually. So, you know, we can see that when we do not follow the biblical laws, we pay a price. And sometimes this horror comes back to visit us just the way these poor veterans are maimed and harmed because the American church did not stand up against that illegal war. The American church does not stand up for the Bible. And so we ask all of you to pray for Carl Sanders. And if you are getting something important from this program, we hope that you will write to us at the Divided Kingdom, Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And again, that is the Divided Kingdom, P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. We would love to have some letters of encouragement or your thoughts on what we're talking about. Most of all, we want you to realize that God is hearing even this small program. And if he likes anything about us, despite our being sinners and our needing to repent just about every day, at least speaking for myself, that's true, he knows that we're doing our best to be obedient, and we're trying to guide the people back from the apostasies and from the apathy and from the lack of believing in the Bible so that we can keep that strong man from being bound up. Well, we had another decision, and this comes under the guise, I believe, of looking like it gives everybody justice and freedom. There's Edith Windsor. She had this long, I don't want to say marriage. She had a relationship with her partner for 44 years, and she was challenging this $363,000 federal estate tax bill because she married Theo Speier, married in quotes, in 2007 after doctors told her friend would not live much longer. So this woman left everything to Windsor, but you see, she had to pay all these taxes because she was not legally married. So now she's going to be eligible for a refund. So we have two different aspects of what the Supreme Court did, and I think we'll give you a good bit of this so you can understand exactly what happened. The first part was the court struck down the provision of a federal law that denied federal benefits to married gay couples, and the second thing was it cleared the way for the resumption of same-sex marriage in California. Now, the will of the people in California was Proposition 8, Lou.
Yes.
They did not want same-sex marriage. Just the way that there are, let me see, can I find this right now? Okay, there is a number here. How many states do not want it? Yes, here we are. Okay. Roughly 36 states do not allow same-sex marriage, including 29 that have enshrined the bans in their constitutions. Now, that's not little, is it?
No, that's a great majority of the states.
36 states. Did you get that, listeners? You hear all this propaganda. You have all these new programs coming on television constantly, and some of them are bringing these non-traditional families. I think I just saw there was a new one. Remember Linda Lavin? We enjoyed seeing her so much in that Alice program decades ago. She's now 75, and what's she prostituting? She's playing in this NBC, Sean Saves the World, okay? He is a divorced gay dad. This is Jack McFarland. And Sean Hayes, I guess that's his real name. I didn't know him that much because we didn't watch Will and Grace. Of course we didn't. Well, anyway, he was wacky Jack McFarland. He's returning to NBC as the divorced gay dad who tries to balance his work life with taking care of his teenage daughter who moves in with him. Beloved Alice star Linda, now 75, plays his pushy mother. Well, I hope that that all gets what it should get eventually. But back to the Supreme Court ruling, this technical ruling that didn't really speak about same-sex marriage, but it left in place the trial court's declaration that California's Proposition 8 was unconstitutional. So you see, they used the higher court system to do something. Now, the federal appeals court has to lift its hold on the lower court ruling, possibly next month. And so this is kind of like, what would you say, winning by stealth?
I'd call it that, yes.
So Governor Jerry Brown, you know, quick as a, bunny, ordered that marriage licenses be issued to gay couples just as soon as this federal appeals court lifted its hold on the lower court ruling. So the people's will is not going to be honored there in California. But it could have been even worse. But President Obama was happy. This article in the AP says, President Barack Obama praised the court's ruling on the Federal Marriage Act, which he labeled, quote, discrimination enshrined in law. It treated loving, committed gay and lesbian couples as a separate and lesser class of people. And he said this in a statement. The Supreme Court has righted that wrong, and our country is better off for it. Well, many of you out there would disagree quite a bit, I think. And now, the Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the majority opinion, that is the ruling in the California case, joined by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, Elena Kagan, and Antonin Scalia. Now, this omission of any kind of responsibility that we see everywhere in our country now, because the conscience is beginning to fade. We have no authority to decide this case on the merits, and neither did the Ninth Circuit, Robert said, referring to the federal appeals court that also struck down Proposition 8. See, in other words, it's a technicality that was unconstitutional.
Yes.
They don't get into the morality of it. No, of course not. Now, Kennedy said, Anthony Kennedy wrote the case, a brief, I guess, for the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, and he said, and he was joined by the court's liberal justices, under DOMA, same-sex marriage couples have their lives burdened by reason of government decree in visible and public ways. DOMA's principal effect is to identify a subset of state-sanctioned marriages and make them unequal, he said. Now, isn't that interesting? Biblically, there is no such thing as same-sex marriage.
Right.
So, state-sanctioned marriages, making them unequal, you see, he's trying there to elevate this as if a cat is a dog.
Yeah.
You see, it's a kind of a propaganda, I think. So, anyway, we now have the rundown here that the rulings came, and this is the AP article speaking, 10 years to the day after the court's Lawrence versus Texas decision that struck down state bans on gay sex. I believe it was called sodomy. In his dissent, and I'm interjecting that, back to the article, in his dissent at the time, Scalia predicted the ruling would lead to same-sex marriage. And that was true. The strong man is being bound, and the erosion is going to be much worse if we don't pray, if we don't take action. And now you might say, well, what can I do? What can I do? Well, ask God every day. You know, today I got an appeal from a magazine, a decorating magazine. Please, please rejoin us because we stopped our subscription. We let it go. And we could get this now for only $5.99, I believe it was. Please, if money is an issue. Well, I turned it over and I wrote a letter that money was not the issue. That when we began to see that this magazine had so many non-traditional families featured, that it had become an agenda, that we didn't really like this being pushed on us. And we said we didn't mind if there was a small percentage, because after all, I'm not a homophobic person, and you aren't either, Lou.
No.
I feel sad that people would choose this lifestyle. Yes, I said choose. We have another report that says many of the gay people say the age they first began to think they might be gay was age 10. Well, what about age 1 to 9? You know, I don't think any of them were created this way. We do make choices, and we do have things in society that push us into things. So, you know, at any rate here, let me get back to this article again. Massachusetts was the first state to allow gay couples to marry in 2004. Aren't you ashamed of where you came from?
My home state.
Your parents would be very sad.
They would.
When same-sex unions resume in California, there will be 13 states representing 30% of the U.S. population where gay marriage is legal. The other 11 are Connecticut, Delaware, Iowa, Maine, Maryland, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New York, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington. All right, so this is the story, and we do need prayer, and we do need action. And when we think about this death and life, things happen by degrees. And I'm going to bring up Auschwitz because Friday, June the 14th, there was a dedication of a new type of exhibit that was going to tell the victim's story in images and sound. This was written by William Booth in the Washington Post. And they talked about in the communist era, there wasn't much really of a memorial there, and they felt that key artifacts had gone missing and that the history presented in the signage was inaccurate at best and was dominated by Soviet propaganda. So in 2005, the then Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon asked Yad Vashem to redesign the memorial. So on Thursday, Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, joined Polish dignitaries and a handful of Holocaust survivors to dedicate a new permanent exhibition in Block 27 called Shoah, part of the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum. And I want to interject here that please keep Anita Dittman, 86-year-old Holocaust survivor, in your deepest prayers. God allowed her graciously to come through a hip replacement operation, and we do hope that if it is his plan for her to continue her wonderful ministry to tell her story that is in the book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell, which you can get at lighthousetrails.com, Lighthouse Trails Publishing, probably it is, .com. Anyway, we hope we'll be getting to interview her again. Now, Netanyahu said something. He said, I am standing here today with great pain and great pride. The leaders of the Allies knew full well what was happening in the death camps. They could have acted, but they didn't. We, the Jews, know exactly what the lesson is. And he says that the murderous anti-Semitism of the Nazi era has been replaced in modern times by religious fanaticism, alluding to Iran, which Israel has accused of trying to create a nuclear arsenal to threaten the Jewish state. Quote, this is a regime that is building nuclear weapons with the express purpose to annihilate Israel's 6 million Jews, Netanyahu said. We will not allow this to happen. We will never allow another Holocaust. And they talked about, there was a little part of the exhibit that had children's drawings. And they talked about the progression here, Lou. First, there are crude renderings of happy times, a girl with a flower, or a family celebrating the Sabbath. Then there is a soldier brandishing a weapon and taking a girl into a forest, and the soldier arriving back alone. Later, trains arriving at the camps, then gallows, graves. And what we would say here is 9/11 began the lifting of God's hand of protection on this country, and we all know that some of those remains there went to a landfill, and we've heard about the mix-ups where some of the soldiers' remains were taken to pet crematoria and things like this. You see, the horror is coming because we will not believe in the Bible literally, and I'm not sure whether we will get into tonight how this horror is returning home on us if we can't, with the TSA beginning to target the handicapped children in wheelchairs. And Lou has quite a bit on this, and we may be talking with Dr. Nick Bagich about this too, but we're not sure how much we'll be able to get into tonight. But we are thinking about the sadness of choosing death over life. People think that they're picking what is good from their human mind because they don't read what is in the Bible. And Lou, you have a very striking article.
And this appeared in Time magazine. This was the issue of, let me see the date here.
I think it's June 24th.
I believe you're
and
right.
And I think
about
you
that.
Said to me it
no,
needs,
July 1st.
July 1st.
July 1st.
And it needs no commentary.
Yeah,
it
needs no comment. It's entitled The Horror Upstairs.
And you're going to read a long excerpt.
Yes. This is by Elizabeth Diaz with Jim Downs. Frances Dufresne lived for Sunday nights. Tall and lean with a pile of blonde hair, the 21-year-old would take two buses from his home in New Orleans suburbs to make it to the upstairs lounge by 5 p.m., when the French Quarter bar held its weekly beer bust, 2 hours of all-you-can-drink drafts for $1. From the outside, the upstairs didn't look much different from the other gay bars on a particularly seedy stretch of Iberville Street. But up 13 steps on the second floor was a refuge. 3 adjoining rooms, decorated with red wallpaper and frilly curtains, where people could laugh, love, even worship without fear. The Metropolitan Community Church, MCC, a national Christian denomination founded to serve gays and lesbians, often held services in the bar's backroom theater. At other times, the space was used for the elaborately costumed drag cabaret performances that regulars called Nelly Dramas. Says Dufresne, it was my safe haven. The beer bust on June 24, 1973, was typically festive. A pianist from the nearby Marriott played Broadway in ragtime tunes as patrons sang along. Dufresne was there, as usual, this time on a first date with Eddie Hosea Warren, a, quote, husky country boy, unquote. He met at a hamburger joint near the upstairs lounge. Warren's brother James and mother Inez came with him. Dwayne George Mitchell, an associate pastor at the MCC, known for his Queen Victoria impersonation, and his partner, Louis Horace Broussard, stopped by after dropping Mitchell's sons off at a movie. The bus crisis ended at 7, but at least 65 people were still hanging around nearly an hour later when the door buzzer went off. It kept ringing, even though no one had ordered a taxi. The bartender sent a regular to check it out. When he opened the door, a fireball burst through as if shot from a flamethrower. An updraft sucked the fire in, and within seconds, the walls were aflame. Panic erupted inside. The bartender, Douglas Buddy Rasmussen, called for people to follow him and led at least 30 of them, that is, at least 20 of them, to safety through a back exit and onto adjoining rooftops before closing the door behind them when he didn't see anyone else coming, to prevent the fire from spreading. Many raced to jump out of the three large windows that were covered by metal bars. Dufresne was one of the few who squeezed through, body on fire. Quote, the small people seemed to get through the window, but the bigger people just couldn't get out, a survivor told the New Orleans Times-Picayune. One of those trapped was the MCC's pastor, Bill Larson, who struggled to push an air conditioning unit through the window to escape. His head, torso, and one arm made it halfway out before the glass pane above collapsed, trapping his body. In the streets below, his friends heard him scream, "Oh, God, no," as flames consumed him. His body was left in the window for hours, with his watch stopped at a few minutes after 8, a haunting relic. And then it was over. Firefighters extinguished the blaze 16 minutes after receiving the alarm. 29 people burned alive that night. 3 more died soon after. Many could be identified only by dental records. A Times-Picayune headline called the scene Hitler's Incinerators, but it made little more than a ripple in the national consciousness. Neither the mayor nor the governor spoke out. Local religious leaders were mostly silent, and only one congregation in the French Quarter ultimately agreed to hold a memorial service. A 2-month police investigation turned up a can of lighter fluid at the scene, and a thrown-out patron overheard threatening to burn this place down. But no one was ever prosecuted. Dufresne puts it bluntly, "I guess they figured they were gay. So what?" The scale of the tragedy was immense. It remains the deadliest fire ever in New Orleans, and is believed to be the largest killing of gay people in U.S. history. And yet it is little discussed, barely acknowledged by the city, or seen as a milestone in the gay rights movement. Today the site is marked only by a square brass plaque on the sidewalk where the bar's entrance used to be. It's easy to miss, unless you're looking for it, a fitting commemoration for an event not everyone wants to remember. Despite the city's reputation for tolerance, there were consequences to being gay there in 1973. One victim, a teacher, was fired while in critical care at Charity Hospital after his school learned that he had been at the bar. He died days later from burns. Many of those killed and injured were effectively outed when the papers published lists of the victims. 2 survivors appeared on television on the condition that their names and faces would not be revealed. Others had to go to work on Monday morning as if nothing happened. Dwayne Mitchell, then 11, and his 8-year-old brother Steve knew something was wrong when their father never came to pick them up. They watched a movie, Disney's The World's Greatest Athlete, 7 times before realizing he wouldn't show. Dwayne says Mitchell had escaped the blaze by following Rasmussen out the back door, but he ran back in to retrieve Broussard. Police found their bodies fused together, dead in each other's arms. Quote, "We didn't even know that he was gay," Dwayne, now 51, says of his father. In 1973, he adds, such things were barely discussed. Quote, "A lot of people didn't even claim their relatives," he said. "I guess they were so ashamed of it." When Perry, now Perry, by the way, was the founder of this church ministering to gays. When Perry tried to find a site to hold the memorial, churches closed their doors. New Orleans was then 47% Catholic, but the archdiocese refused to help. Baptist churches hung up on him. An Episcopal church, led by a friend of Lassen's, held a prayer service but declined to host the memorial after the presiding bishop received dozens of angry phone calls and letters of protest. Quote, "It was like that over and over again," Perry, now 72, says. "My biggest disappointment as a Christian minister to this day was the churches, the way they responded to me," unquote. Just months earlier, two less deadly fires in New Orleans received far more attention. In November, six died in the blaze of the Rawls Center, and eight died in a January arson at a downtown Howard Johnson's. In both cases, Mayor Moon Landrieu and Governor Edwin Edwards issued statements of condolence. Philip Hannon, the city's powerful Catholic archbishop, who eulogized President John F. Kennedy and Senator Robert Kennedy, and later presided over Jacqueline Onassis's funeral, offered his support. After the upstairs lounge fire, Hannon was silent, while public officials limited their statements to calls for improving the city's fire code. For the gay community, Lassen's mannequin-like body, which remained visible in the window past midnight, became a symbol of the city's indifference toward them. Given that reception, it's understandable why so many were skeptical of the police investigation. Homicide detectives interviewed survivors at Charity Hospital shortly after the fire was put out. They spent nearly 12 hours in the scene and soon had more than 50 officers assigned to the case. Witness accounts were conflicting, which was not surprising, given that many people were badly injured, traumatized, and still drunk. But those who saw the fire erupt all used language consistent with arson to describe it. One compared it to a fireball, another to a Molotov cocktail. Police found an accelerant, a 7-ounce can of Ronsonol lighter fluid left empty in the stairwell. A clerk in a nearby Walgreens said someone purchased an identical can of lighter fluid not long before the fire started, but she could not identify the person. The investigation lasted 2 months. At the end of a 64-page report issued in August, the department concluded, quote, "Although there is speculation of arson, as of the writing of this report, there is no physical evidence to indicate anything other than this being a fire of undetermined origin," unquote. The coroner classified all 32 deaths as accidental fire fatalities. Three bodies were never identified. Sam Gevier, then 26, was a lead investigator in the case. He says today that the chief of detectives' statement about the upstairs patrons was taken out of context, and that the police put its full weight behind the case. Quote, "In my whole experience in the homicide division, that never played into anything," he says. "That was one of the biggest multi-deaths that I had ever been on the scene of. We pulled out every stop."
It's a very sad case, and, you know, we would have great compassion for the families left and for the people who died. But we also know that looking at things in a biblical way, this was not your typical place of worship, Lou. When it said, up 13 steps on the second floor was a refuge. Three adjoining rooms decorated with red wallpaper and frilly curtains where people would let love, even worship without fear. So we can get the picture there of the homosexual love and the worship all mingled together. And this picture really is stunning of this Reverend Bill Larsen, his body visible in a window for hours. We would have to ask, is there a judgment by God? And it's a sad lifestyle. And we do have compassion. Here was an article, November 19, 2012, from Globe. Liberace lovers, sad last days. Liberace's former toy boy lover, Scott Thorson, is broken at death's door as he battles deadly stage 2 cancer, say sources. And, of course, it said what it was. It was anal cancer. Once sporting a head of glorious golden locks, the 54-year-old decided to shave them off because chemotherapy is making his hair fall out in clumps. "I want to cry right now," he says. "I was brushing it, and it was just coming out in gobs. Doctors told me I would be losing it, told me I'd get sick from the chemo and the side effects and things happening." As Globe reported in our September 3rd issue, Thorson has anal cancer, which killed 62-year-old Charlie's Angels Beauty, Farrah Fawcett in 2009, and the rampaging disease has spread to his lungs. He says he's been inspired in his fight against the disease by actor Michael Douglas, who beat stage 4 throat cancer and is playing Liberace in the movie version of Thorsen's book, Behind the Candelabra. Matt Damon plays Thorsen, who had a 6-year affair with a piano man in the flick due out next year on HBO. Now Thorsen is struggling to pay his medical bills. A source told Globe, the $95,000 he got to settle a $113 million palimony suit against Liberace's estate is long gone, as is the payout for his 1988 Candelabra book. So it goes on. It's very pathetic. He said he wasn't feeling good. He was doing a lot of internal bleeding. It had been going on for a year and a half. The doctor said, oh, don't worry, and then he demanded tests. He said, I'm not going to let it get me down. Well, we can't make any statements medically about what happened to him, but spiritually, we can know that Almighty God gave us the Bible, and as Bible-believing Christians, we do believe that it is a sinful lifestyle to be in the homosexuality. But everything is under assault, and we know again about this idea of the cremation business, this cremation that's just taking over everywhere in our country, and what we know is it's becoming more popular. And as it does, unbelievable stories of errors and misidentifications have cropped up, like at the Tri-State Crematory incident in Noble, Georgia in 2002. They found all these hundreds of bodies thrown in holes, stacked in piles, 334 in hearses, in all phases of decompositions. And what the family had been given was cement dust instead of remains. And you see, we're under attack here because the spiritual underpinning is not what it was. So the worth of the human individual is not too much. And we can look at this map. We'll get into this more another evening. But the highest cremation rate is pretty much in the states of Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Colorado, Montana, Arizona. Now, the best states, the lowest rate is Mississippi, 16%. Alabama is low. So we say, what they say here, this is what they're saying, and again, we don't want the strong man to be bound. A greener ending? The U.S.'s history as a predominantly Christian nation has arguably been the one true barrier holding cremation back. That helps explain why there are still fewer cremations in the South than any other region in the U.S. In more secular Europe, cremation rates in many countries are much higher. Revelation in the New Testament foretells a time when a trumpet will sound and the dead in Christ shall rise first as Jesus returns. It doesn't say anything about the dead rising from their reefs. And they opened this article with the story of a guy who loved fish and he wanted his remains in the reef. And sort of lugubriously, we had old friends visit us right after I had read this article, and they said, we took Marion north, that's why they stopped to see us. What? They had followed her directions. She had given directions to be cremated, so they followed the directions as friends to take her up to somewhere in Maine and put her ashes out there in the water. And just the way they talked about her, we left Marion in the car. And it was creepy. It was worse than creepy. Are we going to let this reprobate mind come into the hearts even of good Christians? Because these were two good Christian people. Are we going to let it go till we had the TSA traumatizing the 3-year-old in the wheelchair who had, I think, the spina bifida? Are we going to do anything about it? We hope and pray that you will tell others about this program and that you will write to us at the Divided Kingdom. P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. Thank you for listening.
Good night.